Welcome to Political Rewind. It is 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. If you're way up north in the mountains, if you're dealing with icy road conditions, drive safely. Don't let anything that anyone says on this show today take your attention off the roads. We want you to drive very, very carefully today. With us today, as he always is, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He oversees Political Insider, the daily blog that keeps you updated hour by hour on politics. His good friend, Virginia Galloway, no relation, Virginia
anymore.
From Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition. Howard Franklin, he's a Democratic political consultant and a government affairs man at the state capitol. Another way of saying he's one of the lobbyists down there. Jackie Gingrich Cushman, a Republican consultant, a syndicated columnist, a blogger. And we welcome back Ben Swan. Ben is the principal male anchor at CBS 46. He and I do political analysis over there couple nights a week, and I've come to really admire and respect his thinking about politics. So, Ben, thank you for being here as well.
Glad to be here.
All right. Look, you know, there's a lot we're going to talk about today, but I don't think we can start any place. But with the big announcement last night in Ames, Iowa, Donald Trump welcomed onto the stage. She's back, Sarah Palin. Let's listen to Sarah Palin talking about what Donald Trump is going to do to ISIS as president of the United States.
So troops, hang in there because help's on the way, because he, better than anyone, isn't he known for being able to command fire? You ready for a commander-in-chief who will let our warriors do their job and go kick ISIS ass? Ready for someone who will secure our borders, to secure our jobs, and to secure our homes. Ready to make America great again. Are you ready to stump for Trump? I'm here to support the next president of the United States, Donald Trump.
Sarah Palin and Ames. Jim Galloway, you know, when Howard Dean gave that kind of, you know, that victory screech in Iowa after losing the caucuses, it took him down. Sarah Palin seems to be able to get away with it just fine.
Yeah, can you give me a hallelujah?
So what do you make of this announcement?
Look, I think it matters. I really do. It's a kind of a natural combination, and Cruz was kind of edging away from Trump in Iowa. I think this will give Trump some stability in Iowa, which I think is very important in the race as a whole, because I think what this will do is if even if he doesn't win Iowa, if he stays close to Cruz in Iowa, he's leading by leaps and bounds in New Hampshire. And what I think it does is it really positions him. It breaks down this firewall that Ted Cruz thinks that he has in the South. He's got great organization in the South, and he's called that his firewall, just like Hillary has.
All right. I have a feeling I am going to be the minority in this room on this today, Jackie. I think a couple things. Number one, it strikes me that Sarah Palin's power is very, very limited, maybe just to what happens in Iowa and no further than that. But I'm not even sure she continues to maintain the kind of appeal to that base that Trump figures she's going to rally. I get that I'm probably alone in feeling this way.
I think a couple of things. First of all, clearly, since she's been not as in the public eye recently as she was historically, then, you know, she's not as well known and not visible. But she's still very, very, she resonates with a lot of people. I think more importantly than her, I think if you, especially the clip you just said of what she's talking about, of what he brings to the race, I think that actually explains a lot about why Trump appeals to a lot of people. There's a fascinating article in Politico magazine called The One Weird Trait That Predicts Whether You're a Trump Supporter. It's by Matthew McWilliams. He did some research, and it is fascinating because it's not race, income, or education levels. It's authoritarianism. And it's just fascinating because what she's speaking to is he's the one that can provide you with safety. He's the one that can make sure you're in a safe house, that the troops are going to keep you safe. And this is what is really resonating with voters. And it's not just Republicans. It's also independents and Democratic voters. So I think more than just her endorsement, what she embodies, I think really tells you a lot about what's drawing people to Trump.
This is Howard. I actually agree with Jackie, but for a very different reason. I think that while this Republican field is still relatively fractured, you don't need an endorser with deep reservoirs of support across the entire Republican Party. I think you need, you know, someone who resonates with 10, 15, 25%. And I think that's a bump in the places that Trump is looking
for.
That's,
and Ben, I was going to ask about it in sort of in a similar context. One thing it strikes me that she certainly can offer to him is to be a surrogate for him as Iowa really takes, as it already has, really center stage. She can be in places that he's not, rallying the troops on his behalf, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Look, three things about Sarah Palin. First of all, number one, she's doing exactly what you said. She's a draw. Whether people like her or don't like her, they're talking about her. And so she's certainly a draw for people in Iowa, and I think across the South as well. I think in South Carolina she'll be a draw. I think she'll be a draw here in Georgia. I think really across the South, where Trump is not necessarily going to be as strong as maybe Ted Cruz. But something else that's very important to consider. Sarah Palin was the person who first came out and endorsed Ted Cruz when he was running for the Senate in Texas. And it was her endorsement that then turned Eric Erickson, it turned Mark Levin, it turned even Congressman Ron Paul at the time to pay attention to this guy. He was running against David Dewhurst, who was the sitting lieutenant governor at the time. Remember that?
Yep.
And so Sarah Palin, it was her endorsement that shifted the attention onto Ted Cruz to say he's a legitimate candidate. Well, the fact that she's come along now, you know, not only is she able to draw away some of those people probably from Cruz, but she's also doing the thing that Trump does so well, changing the conversation. Trump doesn't like the conversation, and he finds a way to change it. And in this case, whether we like it or don't like it, again, the bottom line is everyone today is talking about Sarah Palin.
Yeah, if I could pose a question to my friend Ms. Galloway.
Yeah, we
here.
Need to go right to Virginia Galloway, supporter
okay,
in the room.
We've got Ralph Reed, the head of your organization, quoted in the New York Times, is saying that Sarah Palin's brand among evangelicals is golden, as gold as Donald Trump's faucets, if you will. He said that. This is a guy who quotes 2 Corinthians 3:17.
Right.
So tell me about that.
You want me to comment on what Ralph said or what I think about the Palin?
Tell me what you think.
First of all, she does have a lot of influence in that area. But I think the people that are attracted, think about McCain and Palin. They were polar opposites, you know, in the public eye. He was very cold. She was very warm and kind of a little outrageous. And he was very reserved and, you know, straight down the line. And so she brought a lot of new people and a lot of new energy into that campaign. I don't think that's the case here. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the kind of people that are attracted to Sarah Palin are the kind of people that are already on Trump's campaign.
I do think that I think this is a big blow to Cruz. I mean, he got the endorsement from Sarah Palin last time. Clearly, you can see the news coming out on the Twitter for the spokesperson, Rick Tyler, who used to work for my father, Newt Gingrich. I know Rick very well. Clearly, they were, you know, waiting to see. And I think that's a huge disappointment for the team. I mean, when you're sitting in a team, you're waiting for those endorsements. You're hoping you get them. And for one that came to you in an earlier race to go to somebody else, I mean, clearly you can't say that out in the public eye, but it's a blow.
Well, Virginia, and you have made it clear to us that Ted Cruz is your man, and certainly you have high hopes for him here in Georgia. You don't think that Palin changes the equation for how Cruz ought to do in Georgia? I don't think has that kind of strength here.
I don't either. A lot of people, and that tone that she had, just even in the clip that she played, I mean, it was like, you know, fingernails on a chalkboard. and by the way, I mean, I really don't define myself as being in one camp or another. I like a couple of the candidates very well, and Cruz is one of them that I like very well.
Did you wink when you said that, Virginia?
I was watching. She didn't.
Here's the other thing. So Sarah Palin aside, I think Ted Cruz is making a couple of other missteps as well as of late. And one of the mistakes I think he's made is that Ted Cruz has done a very good job over the past 6 to 8 months of really rallying liberty or libertarian-leaning Republicans who were typically kind of in Rand Paul's camp. And he's drawn a lot of them in. And certainly he's been strong on a lot of these issues. But over the last few weeks, he's taken some steps that would make people say, wait a minute, what's going on here? I mean, the fact that he did not disclose properly the FEC form related to Goldman Sachs puts a lot of questions in people's minds. He came out, 5 days ago and said that Edward Snowden is a traitor and should be tried for treason. So some of those folks who have really been kind of in the Rand camp, who had defected to Cruz as more of the, if you will, for lack of a better term, more legitimate contender with a chance, may be starting to rethink him a little bit because he's becoming more establishment in some of the steps he's taking. So, again, I think some of those missteps are not necessarily good for him.
Go ahead, Virginia.
Speaking of people, though, that are looking for a candidate that might make it, I think that he gets a lot of game from other candidates that are dropping out now. You know, I mean, I just really can't see most of them going toward Trump. Maybe some toward Rubio and some towards Cruz.
I think
they'll divvy them up.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. The first battle is Iowa. Howard, you know, kind of a double blow yesterday for Ted Cruz. He loses Sarah Palin, who, as Ben points out, was certainly instrumental in his successful run for Senate, which he says every chance he can, including yesterday as the rollout with Palin was coming. He handled it, you've got to say, probably the way you'd want your candidate to. He was gracious about it and that sort of thing. It had to hurt. Then Governor Branstad, the sitting governor of this Republican governor of the state of Iowa, tells the people of Iowa this.
I think that Ted Cruz is ahead right now, but what we're doing is we're trying to educate the people of Iowa. He is the biggest opponent of renewable fuels, and he actually introduced a bill in 2013 to immediately eliminate the renewable fuel standard. He is heavily financed by big oil. So we think that once Iowans realize that fact, they might find other things about him attractive, but I think it would be very damaging to our state, and that's the reason why he hasn't been invited to this, because he hasn't supported renewable fuels, and I believe that would be a big mistake for Iowa to support him. And I know he's ahead in the polls, but the only poll that counts is the one they take on caucus night, and I think it could change between now and then. I think this event is an important, significant step to helping educate the voters in this state.
Talking, of course, about Ted Cruz, Howard, that hurts.
It does, and I think it hurts for a reason we haven't seen a whole lot of in this presidential cycle, which is a substantive policy issue that's, you know, striking directly into the hearts of Iowans.
Please. That is said by the man who is heavily invested himself in ethanol. So don't give me
ballot.
That. He's not on the ballot now, but I think he loses major credibility when he says, oh, this guy's subsidized by oil, and he's subsidized by ethanol.
So really? I don't think that's a hidden – I mean, I think that's kind of well-known in Iowa. I mean, this is the way – I mean, Iowa's been this way for a long time.
Iowa is subsidized.
Absolutely.
Iowa.
And they all know it. I mean,
Ted Cruz has said in Iowa, I'm against ethanol subsidies, and a lot of people in Iowa agree with him. I mean, I know that, yes, that's a big part of their corn economy and so on, but – yeah.
So
yeah.
I think part of the problem is you're not running here for president of the United States. He's running for the president of Iowa in 2 weeks, right? And so you have to be able to appeal specifically to that state. And the bottom line is, if people look at their own bottom line and say this guy might hurt it, it does hurt him, even though in another state it might help him.
No, I would say this actually hurts Cruz far more than the loss of Sarah Palin. This is a pocketbook issue. This, you know, you've got farmers and their accountants pouring over the books, looking at that corn price, and if it falls,
it's a personal issue. It hurts them personally.
But you know what? Okay, so Jackie,
absolutely.
Here's what I found interesting about the interplay between Branstad's statement and Sarah Palin's endorsement yesterday. On one hand, the Palin endorsement further puts a cleaver between the established Republican Party and the outliers, right? I mean, here we go. Sarah Palin's off there with the outsiders. She's, you know, guns a-blazing for outside candidates. But what you've got with Branstad is a guy from the establishment fighting back. So there's an interesting tension and dynamic between those two events, really.
Oh, absolutely. And I think also if you look at Monday, I was at Monday when he went and spoke at Liberty University. Trump did. Yeah, thank you. So Trump went and spoke at Liberty University. And when Jerry Falwell was, Jr. was introducing him, he talked about not only about Trump was a great man, great leader, but he also referred to the fact that his father supported Ronald Reagan. And one of the reasons he supported Reagan as opposed to Jimmy Carter when they were against each other was that even though Jimmy Carter clearly is a very devout man, he's a Sunday school teacher and has been for decades, that he really wanted to support someone that could lead the country. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this, again, this idea that you have to have someone strong that can keep our country safe, that's an outsider, will play for the conservative base who might traditionally have gone with someone that's more evangelical.
I would I'd agree and on most of those accounts. I think really this makes me rethink how good Trump might be as a politician and as a strategist. I mean, you've got the outsider offering more outside cred to his candidacy, and you've got the insider attacking his fiercest rival from the inside.
I want to play for you, Howard, the Democrat at the table, one of the other sound bites from Sarah Palin's speech in which she talks about President Obama, and get your reaction to the language she uses.
Just last week, we're watching our sailors suffer and be humiliated on a world stage at the hands of Iranian captors in violation of international law. Because a weak-kneed capitulator-in-chief has decided that America will lead from behind.
So, Howard, in the long run, right now we're playing for Iowa, but in the long run we're going to have a general election campaign. Is this the kind of language that is going to sway general election voters away from Democrats?
Absolutely not. But I mean, that's the beauty of having a surrogate like her. She gets to say it without Trump having to say it. Obviously, and my feelings aside here, I think, President Obama was damned if he did and damned if he didn't. Right. So this isn't a question of whether or not you'd have detractors or folks praising the work that the country's done in order to free those Iranian hostages. But I do think this is another point score for Trump to have someone who can go rally the base. And whip folks into a fervor.
It's amazing. Trump has finally got someone who can make him sound, will allow him to sound reasonable. Is this what you're saying?
Great strategist, right?
All right. I want to keep going. We've discussed Palin for the time being. Well, they're, by the way, right now, they're at a rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, together again. It'll be interesting to see how the conversation between Trump and Palin goes there. But before we get off the Republicans, I want to take a look at what's going on in the Rubio campaign. I thought this was one of the funniest stories that came out of the political campaign this week. Marco Rubio, who has been getting it from Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and others about not quite being masculine enough, attacked over the boots that he was wearing. And there's been all sorts of language out there. So Rubio is on a macho offensive. We learn later that on Christmas Eve, he's gone out and bought a handgun. Let's listen to what he had to say about that.
I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I have a right to protect my family if someone were to come after us. In fact, if ISIS were to visit us or our communities at any moment, the last line of defense between ISIS and my family is the ability that I have to protect my family from them or from a criminal or anyone else that seeks to do us harm.
So what I find, Jim Galloway, look, I mean, that's kind of funny. I do think it's interesting the New York Times took it seriously enough to write a piece about Rubio trying to show his masculine credibility here.
Well, it's not just an assault on his masculinity. It's also an assault on his youth.
That's it.
And
right.
That's the key to it. I mean, you had Chris Christie in the last Republican debate say that Hillary Clinton's going to pat him on the head and then cut his heart out.
Right.
He is poised. He's well spoken in these debates, but the face tells it all.
Jackie, something doesn't quite his numbers. Don't seem to be moving much right now. It is the impression of a lot of people, and I will admit I'm one of them, that he's there's something not quite working there right now. Do you see that at all?
Well, I think he had a very good debate performance last time. I thought he handled himself very well in the
debate stage.
He
always does, yeah.
I thought he did better in the last debate. But I do think when you put him next to someone who is so aggressive on stage, Trump is incredibly aggressive on stage. Cruz clearly in the last debate was very aggressive as well. And Christie, you have Christie. I think unless you stand up and rip your shirt off and, you know, beat your chest, it's hard to appear as aggressive as they are. And I think because of the contrast, it makes a difference. In a different set of people, I think he would look different.
This Republican primary is all about authenticity. And I think that's where Marco Rubio falls a little bit short. He's very competent. He's well spoken, but I think but some of his language is looks a little bit forced.
You say that, but if you look at Cruz, I've got to say Cruz did a great job in the debate. But those answers were so, you could tell they were rehearsed. You could tell he spit them out. He couldn't change what he was saying. He had to get everything out. So I hear what you're saying about authenticity, and I mean, clearly Trump has that. I mean, he is authentically himself everywhere he goes. But I'd say that that's not necessarily true for all the candidates.
Well, and I think a couple things on that. First of all, I think in the last debate, Cruz was probably less dynamic than he has been in any of the others because he did seem so rehearsed and he seemed so careful, whereas he had been more dynamic in some of the other debates. But look, Marco Rubio getting the jazz here because he's wearing a pair of boots, which, by the way, I wear exactly the same kinds of boots.
I think yours are a little prettier.
Mine are actually nicer. They are, actually. And they're a little more manly. By the way, for Ted Cruz's campaign, if you're listening, they're called ropers, not short boots. But beyond that
would have made a big difference, actually.
It would have. Look, the bottom line is Marco Rubio, I think he's making a huge mistake by even engaging in this, because when you start trying to defend against it, it makes you look like there is something there. But look, a lot of these same claims about youthfulness and about being too, for lack of a better term, effeminate, those were all kind of lobbed at Barack Obama when he was running as a freshman senator, and he's too young, and he ate
arugula. I mean, come on.
Here he comes out of the ocean. Remember the shirtless picture coming out of the ocean? Bottom line is it didn't slow him down at all, and it actually helped him, I think, tremendously among female voters. And so this whole idea that you've got to be tough, and young people, and this idea that he's too metro. Chris Christie really is going to complain about the appearance of Marco Rubio? It seems ridiculous to me.
I agree. And he also is very conservative. I mean, if you look at his heritage rating and that kind of thing, I mean, for anybody to try to say that he's liberal or he hasn't taken a stand for anything or whatever, I mean, look at his Heritage Foundation rating.
The problem that Rubio has is not his appearance. That's his biggest asset, I think, that he looks a certain way, that he carries himself a certain way. The liability for Rubio is that the neocon kind of policies he advocates that a lot of younger voters would not appreciate or like. So he has a youthful image appealing to an older demographic, and that's his rub, not the boots he's wearing.
So before we take a break and move on to talk about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, is there, in Jackie, are we in Virginia? You should weigh in too. Have we once and for all reached the point where it is increasingly certain that an outsider will be the Republican nominee for President of the United States?
Well, I think two things. I think outsider both for the Republicans, but also I think this is also explains why Sanders is doing so well. There was a poll out today that said when people were asked, this is both Republicans and Democrats, what's more important, experience in politics, 36%, or someone who will bring greater changes, less experience, 61%. The country is calling for someone from the outside. You see it on both sides of the race. So I think, I mean, you never know what's going to happen. I never would have thought Trump would have made it this far, so I'm certainly not going to look into the crystal ball, but it certainly looks that way.
I agree. I think that we're going to see an outsider win. I mean, the top three candidates are all kind of somewhat outsiders to one degree or another, and certainly considered by the establishment as outsiders. I mean, when I was on this program before, we were talking about Bush's certain chance of being the nominee, or near certain chance.
Wait a minute. It can't have possibly been that long since you've been
on. She needs to come back more often.
I'd love to agree that that's going to happen on the Republican side. It feels like, you know, and I'm 36, looking back at the presidential elections I've been old enough to witness, it seems like the Democratic side is much more apt, much more likely to nominate an outsider to take the White House and the presidency. It typically, when these things shake out on the Republican side, presidential politics, we do find our way to an establishment candidate. Now, I know that Bush hasn't done terribly well, but I wonder if anybody else will start to look more like an establishment candidate.
Well, there's a little sliver, tiny sliver of light for John Kasich. in New Hampshire. He's polling well. He's on the rise there. But Lord, after you pass New Hampshire, it's a long time to Ohio.
Jim, does this as we take our break, does this point the Republican contest now more to the importance of the SEC primary, the March 1st primary?
Oh, absolutely. I think it will define the nomination.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right, let's do this. Let's take a break. It's 2:31. You're listening to Political Rewind. Short break, and we'll come right back with more.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network. Good afternoon. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, collaborating with universities in China, Korea, Turkey, Brazil, and South Africa.
Support for GPB comes from our generous members and the Southern Environmental Law Center, protecting healthy air, clean water, and special places throughout the South, from the mountains to the coast. Information at southernenvironment.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. With us, Virginia Galloway from the Faith and Freedom Coalition, Howard Franklin, Democratic consultant, Ben Swan, anchor at CBS 46, Jackie Gingrich Cushman, a Republican writer, strategist, all of those things. Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Howard Franklin, let's talk Democratic politics. And to start this off, let's do a blast from the past.
The headline of this hour, Hillary Clinton fails to break out of the pack, and Barack Obama, just 3 years into his first U.S. Senate term, wins a heartland state.
That 2008, Iowa caucus night. Are we looking at deja vu all over again, Howard?
You know, it's hard to say, but I think a lot of the same touch points are there. I think in much the same way that we've all been wrong trying to figure out, looking in this crystal ball, what would happen in the Republican primary, we might be finally entering a stage where there might be some surprises afoot for Democrats as well.
Well, okay, but what does that mean? I mean, if Bernie Sanders wins Iowa and wins New Hampshire, you know, if we talked about Republicans a lot, there is certainly a path to the nomination. If Trump comes out of Iowa and New Hampshire as a winner, obviously coming south, he's got strength. But what does Bernie Sanders do, even if he wins Iowa and New Hampshire?
Well, I mean, if we're accepting the premise that this firewall is real and that Bernie won't be able to win the support of African-American voters, then maybe there isn't much of an opportunity. But I think there have been a lot of premises knocked down over the last 6 to 8 months, and I'm not really sure at this point that anyone knows what's going to happen in this crystal ball.
Okay, so a couple of things here. First of all, I take exception. You said none of us predicted. Bill knows. I actually have predicted a lot of this. Donald Trump.
You're right.
And Bernie Sanders as well since the summer, and people saying I'm crazy. But here's why, because what I really see here is a repudiation of the two-party system in America. I think most people look at the parties and say there is something really broken here. So it's not that they don't like the individual politicians. I think they're just looking at the party saying this system does not work for me. Right. And so they're listening to other voices. When you have basically Donald Trump, who's not really a Republican, and Bernie Sanders, who's not really a Democrat, and these are the guys who were really drawing most of the energy, because whether you like Clinton or not, she does not have an energetic campaign right now. They're drawing all the energy right now. The question is this: how does Bernie Sanders overcome, if he wins Iowa, which I think he certainly might, but he doesn't have to, New Hampshire? That's almost a given. It's almost like running in his home state. What do you do next? And what the Sanders campaign has been saying is that, first of all, they haven't even begun campaigning yet in those areas because people don't even know who Bernie Sanders is. Part of that's a media issue because media has done a very poor job of talking about him. Part of it is the DNC issue because of the fact that the debates have all been hidden on nights when no one's watching. And there's only six of them, three of them before Iowa. So it's hard to even know who Bernie Sanders is for the average Democratic voter. But if you win those two states, maybe now you have a chance to introduce yourself to those other states.
But Jackie, to the best of my knowledge, a couple of problems here. Number one, Sanders philosophically certainly is in alignment with Southern voters. Now, maybe Ben argues they'll come up with maybe this outsider label could serve him well to some extent. On the other hand, He doesn't have a ground game in Georgia. And I don't think you can all of a sudden say, well, now it's time to start campaigning in Georgia and Alabama and all the other SEC states, can you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's very hard to take. I think you're right. I think he will definitely more than likely win New Hampshire. Will probably do pretty well in Iowa, could win in Iowa. But even if you take that win in New Hampshire, it's hard to translate that, to your point, to a ground game in a March 1st primary. I do think it's fascinating, and Ben, you're exactly right. If you look at Bernie Sanders, he became a Democrat in 2015. And for us to even be sitting here talking about that he has the potential to be the Democratic nominee, I think is just unbelievably fascinating. And the same thing with Trump. But if you look at their positions, Sanders has a very, he talks about he's a Democratic socialist. He's very, incredibly left. And I think even though he's appealing with his energy, I think when people start to understand what he means, I think that a lot of people will kind of, start to kind of waver about, do I really want that?
Let me jump in here now. Bernie Sanders is a very nice fellow. I think if he wins Iowa and New Hampshire, he's still got a terrific problem because Hillary Clinton's vocabulary will be reduced to two phrases. Barack Obama is my best friend, and Bernie is a socialist. And how can you win the South? Even on the Democratic side, with those two thoughts,
I don't know about best friend. I'm sorry.
No,
Ben.
Go ahead.
I'll just say one thing. I mean, 2008. I don't remember some groundswell of a ground game for one Barack Obama. I think winning Iowa validated his chances of actually becoming the president. We were obviously fascinated with him.
Bernie Sanders is no Barack Obama.
Let me finish the point before you cut it off. What I would tell you is that Barack Obama had been introduced to us via the media. Now, he had done so in some very clever ways via, obviously his bio, his book, the accomplishments at Harvard Law School, etc. But I think Bernie will enjoy some time in the sun if, in fact, he comes out of these two early contests as the leading candidate to be the Democratic nominee.
I would love to. I wish that we could do it right here to remember when John Lewis switched his endorsement from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama. Was it pre-Iowa? Was it post-Iowa? Because if you start wanting to know about when the movement took place for Obama in the South.
I can tell you when it started. It started right after New Year's Day, and the first one out of the box was Shirley Franklin.
That's exactly right. So even before Iowa and Barack Obama in Iowa, you had the South starting to look at Obama more seriously.
Elected officials.
Virginia.
But the other person who did it, though, long before even politician, was Oprah Winfrey. Right. Oprah really was a person who, and that was before South Carolina. It was in South Carolina where she made that endorsement. But it had a huge impact in terms of popular culture and the way that people viewed Barack Obama. But keep in mind, the other thing you're forgetting is that what really propelled Obama's campaign were young people, college students, and the youth vote, because they had the energy and put the work in.
Which is
whereas
what
Sanders has
Sanders
that same
has.
Group. Clinton does not.
So so Obama had Oprah, Donald Trump apparently. We'll have Barbara Walters. So that's fine. Virginia, Senator Claire McCaskill made an interesting statement yesterday. She said if Bernie Sanders should be the Democratic nominee, how quickly will we see Republicans go up with ads showing him with a hammer and sickle? I thought that was pretty tough language,
That is pretty tough language. I don't think it would be hard to run a campaign against Bernie Sanders. That's all I'm going to say.
But can I just interject something here? Because we use this term democratic socialist all the time, but the bottom line is most of the programs that we have in the United States run out of our federal government are democratic socialist
programs.
Sure,
we have Social Security, we've got Medicare.
That's why we're in the mess we're in.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But why did you have to give Virginia an opening?
But honestly, what is really the difference between Hillary Clinton's positions on social issues and Bernie Sanders? How far apart are they actually? Now, you can call him a socialist and all those things, but the bottom line is he's really not that far. And actually, he's not that far from Jeb Bush either in terms of a lot of their views on what we would do in terms of government.
I think clearly in the last debate, what you saw Hillary Clinton trying to do was do two things. First of all, as Howard said, she continually talked about her friend, President Obama, because she went to line with him. I think secondarily, she talked about incremental changes. So what she's talking about is taking our current system, Obamacare, making it incrementally better for her base. And when you're looking at Bernie Sanders, he's talking about his idea is a revolution. Now, you can argue about what does that mean, but he wants to get rid of the current healthcare system and get a one new single-payer system, a totally different system. So I do think there is more light between the two of them than you recognize. But again, I think it's fascinating. Bernie has this reach to the college students, but if you look visually at both he and Hillary Clinton, they're both, you know, they're both older. They're both, you know, it's just fascinating. And then you look at Marco Rubio, who we're saying, you know, isn't doing as well on the Republican side, even though now I think he's picking up some votes as people leave.
He is, and he's got a strong base of college students as well.
Absolutely. But I think he would be fascinating to look on stage against either Hillary or Bernie Sanders just because of the visual difference.
The visual difference is there, but when you're talking about the, in terms of who comes out to see Marco Rubio when he speaks, who comes out to see Bernie Sanders, I mean, the guy is speaking in front of crowds of 36, 40,000 people in stadiums, and nobody's done that since Barack Obama. And I'm not a Sanders
I wonder how much they're
here.
Being paid to show up. That's all I'm going to say. You know.
I don't think that's the case here. I think what's really happening here is, look, that Bernie Sanders is speaking about certain issues. And remember, too, in a general election, who are you running for? Democrats and Republicans, percentage-wise, right now in the country, are only about 51% of the electorate combined, which means about 49% of the electorate are now no longer affiliated with the parties, and that's a whole issue, too. You're really running for independence.
All right. Let's back up just a step here, because Jim Galloway, our fact checker, has been online and, in fact, found us a date, because we don't want to mislead people. John Lewis changed his endorsement on
February. He started waffling on February 15th, 2008, and finally switched on February 27th.
So certainly post Iowa caucus,
right?
So all right. So it didn't happen until afterwards. Howard Franklin, we bow to you and your wisdom on that one. So Howard, make a case for us. Let's project Sanders. He surprises Clinton. We have to remember, poor Hillary Clinton came in third in Iowa, not second in 2008.
Right.
She lost to both Obama and John Edwards, and just really, fortunately for her, came back in New Hampshire. Okay, so let's now say Sanders pulls it off in Iowa, New Hampshire. What, if you were advising him, what would you tell him his message is when he comes to Georgia?
Well, I think some of what you guys have said is absolutely true. I do believe an investment in the ground game is important. Before you can make that investment, folks have to believe that you're real. And I think those two victories will get him a long way towards that goal.
Okay, but what is his – I mean, can he use the same message?
I
universal
much like,
Medicare, a tax to pay for health care?
I don't know if it matters whether or not he can or can't.
Free college for everyone.
Free college for everyone.
I don't know that it matters whether or not he can or can't. I think, as Jackie mentioned, these are two very authentic candidates we're talking about with him and Trump. And I don't think he would do anything other than be himself. I do believe, though, if we look at the plight of millennials in the last 5 or 10 years, right? We look at folks who've been crushed underfoot, the shrinking middle class. I think there's certainly a group of voters who is interested in that discourse and that discussion. And I think if he were to present himself as in a way that he could temper some of his, you know, some of the outlandish parts of his candidacy and his personality, I do think there'd be a willing group of people.
Okay, my question is, who does he go, who speaks for him?
Yeah.
In South Carolina, you've had some hints that Jim Clyburn might fulfill that role, which would be very, very important.
It would.
But in Georgia, who would fulfill that role other than Killer Mike? And I cannot, seriously, I cannot, I haven't found that person.
Killer Mike, if you're out there, our invitation to come have you come in here and be on Political Rewind is still outstanding.
Isn't that the point, though? I mean, maybe you don't want politician surrogates out there for you. Maybe you want the Killer Mikes of the world to be the people who are speaking on your behalf, because you're again appealing to people. When Sanders stands up, what does he say every time? He says that there is too much in the ruling class. There's too much connection between government and corporations, that the banking class is ruining America. And so you don't want politicians to be up there advocating for you. You want people who seem like the common man.
If you're a stranger walking into new territory, you got to have somebody by your side that people trust.
with some credibility, yes.
I think he could. I don't know the answer to that question as we're sitting here, but I think he could figure it out before March the 1st. And I think, again, Ben's point is very instructive. I think a lot of this comes down to really dismantling the expectations of traditional politics. That's what we've seen for the last 6, 12, 18 months maybe with the rise of folks like Trump and, you know, folks like Jeb Bush not being able to get a foothold. So if there is a path forward, obviously operating outside of traditional constraints of politics, these are candidates who can do it.
All right. I want to go to both Jackie and Virginia and ask you two the same question that I asked Howard. Jackie, you've worked, you know, did a lot for your father's campaign. You helped him figure out his messages. What do you tell Bernie Sanders about how he refines his message for Southern voters?
I think going back to Jim's point about authenticity, I'm not sure he does.
Okay.
I think watching the candidates, of all the candidates, I can't imagine trying to tell Bernie Sanders how to be Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's going to be exactly who
so
he is.
So you're on the same page
goes.
With Ben and Howard.
And to be perfectly frank, I mean, I was the same with my father. We would all give him, and he's Newt Gingrich wherever he goes. I mean, and he says, as especially reporters know, he says whatever comes into his head that he thinks would be the right thing to say. So,
including get out of my face.
So I do think, you know, that he's very authentic, and I think his message will be continue to be, you know, we need to change, we need to have a revolution.
Will Southerners go for that?
I wouldn't have forecasted 6 months ago. I don't think in the end it'll work. I do think there is a section that will appeal to, but even though there is a huge group of independents in the middle, you still have both Democrats and Republicans on both sides, and to win, you have to be able to pull together, you know, your party and independents. You can't just grab the people that aren't affiliated with anybody.
Virginia, do you think that if Bernie Sanders should somehow miraculously become the Democratic nominee and Donald Trump the Republican nominee, do you think Republicans would have an easy time of winning the White House against a socialist?
Yes.
Even if it's Donald Trump?
Even if it's Trump.
Even if it's Trump.
Well, here's one thing we haven't – if Bernie Sanders wins Iowa and New Hampshire, the one thing we haven't discussed is what does Barack Obama do?
Yeah, does
he jump in?
Yeah.
And who does he pick as his successor?
Well, and already Biden's been doing it. Biden's already been, and not picking him, but Biden's been given a lot of support to the Sanders campaign over the last few weeks.
Yes, he's been, and also at the same time,
Biden
not very nice to Clinton, right?
but as Patricia Murphy told us last week, I mean, in the same show, I mean, Hillary Clinton was Barack Obama's Secretary of State. She was his voice overseas.
Yeah, and I do
look how that worked out for us.
Well, I mean, I think this election, if she's the nominee, will find out whether how people feel about how that worked out for us. I think I would take exception with one aspect of what you said, Ben. Biden, I think, when it comes to Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders probably has his own agenda.
I suspect so.
We know that he said that he's regretting every day that he didn't jump in and run. So I think maybe we take with a grain of salt anything he says about Hillary Clinton.
I think every day he wakes up and says, gosh, I really should have run. I mean, I'll wake up and think that.
I think he does. I think he should have jumped into it.
Absolutely.
I think it would have actually helped Sanders even more because it would have split off more of the Clinton vote.
All right.
Not that I'm advocating for
it. All right, we got to take our last break of the show. It's about 2:48. You're listening to the Wednesday edition of Political Rewind, not to be confused with the Friday edition of Political Rewind, which will be on the air Friday. We'll be right back.
By some estimates, more than 30 million people in the world today live in slavery, toiling in mines, quarries, and shrimp farms without pay or any hope of escape. On the next Fresh Air, Kevin Bales talks about his reporting on humans held in bondage and the environmental havoc slavery wreaks on the planet. Bales' new book is Blood and Earth. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Virginia Galloway, Howard Franklin, Ben Swan, Jackie Gingrich Cushman, Jim Galloway, no relation, as we often point out, to Virginia Galloway, who's sitting across the table from him here today.
Our lawyers forbid it.
Jim, let's talk state politics for a couple minutes. Even as we're on the air here, there is a news conference going on down at the Capitol. We have a reporter, Sam Whitehead, down there. We haven't heard from him yet. But apparently it's about the third congressional district race. It's Senator Josh McCune. Who else is involved in this
news
conference?
First of all, this is for Representative Lynn Westmoreland's third district seat.
Right.
Westmoreland has said he's not going to run, so you've got this mad dash to March 11th qualifying to see who will take his place. It was originally advertised as a press conference featuring Josh McCune, Matt Ramsey, and Mike Crane.
Right.
Mike Crane's a state senator. So is Josh
McCune. So is
McCune. And Matt Ramsey is in the House.
A
state rep out of Peachtree City. We're told, our AJC people are told, that Matt Ramsey has said, no, he's not in this.
And it'll be interesting to see whether McCune...
I don't think McCune is in it either, which kind of means that Mike Crane is your man.
Well, what we were told in advance of this here at GPB, and you got the same word over the newspaper, I'm sure, is... These three have decided to come together and hold a news conference because they want to make it clear there needs to be a consolidated campaign around a conservative candidate for that seat.
Well, you see this a lot of the times. This is not all that unusual to have members of the House or members of the Senate rally behind a single candidate to give them a boost and a fundraising boost.
Right.
This does happen, but. It's not the final word. You could very easily. This is a very conservative district. You win this district once, and you're pretty much set for as long as you feel like going up to Washington. As long as that makes you happy, you know. So you could very well. There are a couple other Virginia. There's a couple other names, aren't there? Is it Jeff Brown, former state lawmaker,
is thinking about this out of LaGrange?
Like,
seven names that are possibilities, but the strongest names that I've heard are the three that are at this press conference. So I would say that there's a good indication that Mike Crane would be a very strong candidate supported by at least some of those people who might have run against him.
Yeah, we think that McCune is more interested in the position of attorney general, I think. We're expecting maybe down the road that Sam Olens decides to vacate that seat to become the...
I think Josh has got a statewide race in him.
Right.
Well, it's entirely possible. He's certainly been all over the state talking about religious liberty, and he's been very well received throughout the state.
Howard Franklin, talking about congressional races, you know, just move a little bit south to the second congressional district. You've got Sanford Bishop sitting down there, a lone Democrat in Republican territory in South Georgia. And there's increasingly talk that this is a guy who just... At a certain point, he's not going to be able to hold on to that seat.
I haven't heard that talk at all. I think, as I understand it, he's got Republican opposition, right? It won't be a Democratic primary. And as I recall, the redistricting, 4 or 6 years ago, strengthened that district for Democrats that he happens to be sitting in. So I don't believe he's in too tough of a position, but I'm sure he'll work as hard as he always does to retain Democratic control of that seat.
Before, Virginia, you got some news for us there.
I do. I looked on Facebook. That's where we get all our news, right?
Be quiet.
And I see that State Senator Mike Crane made his announcement to run to be the next congressman of Georgia's 3rd Congressional District.
Okay. It'll be fascinating to watch all of that unfold down there. Jim Galloway, we are still looking. Speaking of Josh McCune, religious liberty continues to be an issue down there at the Capitol. McCune's SB 129 is there. We haven't talked with Virginia Galloway about this since we began all this conversation. Virginia, your Faith and Freedom Coalition continues to think that SB 129 is an important piece of legislation to pass. Yes?
It certainly is. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, again, it was a national effort back in the 90s. It passed unanimously, bipartisan, piece of legislation, not the least bit controversial. They kind of made it controversial over the last few years, but really it's not. And it has to be passed individually by the states because of a court decision. That said, I want to say that SB 129 may not be the bill that passes, but a RFRA-like bill is needed for the state of Georgia, and it's in every other state around us.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about that specifically is you can probably answer a question that's come up at this table and other programs, and that is McCune and the people who are advocating for 129 or a version of 129 continue to say this is not intended to discriminate in any way.
Correct.
And so help us understand why it is that any anti-discrimination language that's been attempted to amend the bill...
I answered this on this show, but I'll say it again. Because if you are doing... This is an anti-discrimination bill. It is anti-discrimination against people of faith. If I am working for another group, let's just say any group, I'm working for that group, I don't say, unless it interferes with the rights of believers. I just don't put another group in my anti-discrimination bill, any group. I don't give them, in other words, I don't give them a leg up over us.
Jackie, you're looking puzzled.
Because I am, because I'm trying to figure out, so why is there anti-discrimination language attached to the bill if the bill doesn't discriminate?
There isn't. And that, they keep insisting that there should be, and that's where
Jim,
we
you are our fact person. I think they've attached that.
No,
they tried
in the House, and the whole thing was tabled as a result.
Well, no, it is in the bill
right
now.
But then,
right.
But then it's been
the
set aside.
I think part of the reason it's set aside is, there's a question from many people saying, what problem are we trying to solve? Where's the problem that we're trying to solve? And the other thing is that clearly the business community in Atlanta has come out and said, if we're known as a place too busy to hate, and we want to make sure that we have commerce and everything works appropriately, do we need this bill?
When you have an impasse like this in the House, what often happens is you have another piece of legislation come up and take on the mm-hmm. duties of that. And you've got Greg Kirk out of Americus putting out his tomorrow. He will put out his he'll drop his
First Amendment Defense Act,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that one.
It's much stronger than the RFRA. The RFRA, it was very much like the federal bill. It was exactly like the federal bill.
Kirk's is much more overt on the issue.
Kirk's bill will protect certainly public employees, and we'll see how the language goes when he actually drops it, from being... So, for instance, if I'm a clerk... Kirk told us himself that his intention.
The way he explained it is that if a county clerk doesn't want to issue a marriage license to a same-sex couple, he or she defers to the next clerk. If the next clerk defers and so on, then the probate judge
we'll want to talk about this again maybe next week or so after the bill drops, because I think that I've heard some things that may not
right.
be the case.
Right.
Ben Swan, over at CBS 46, you all did a big special about proliferation of guns in Georgia. Keisha Waitz has a bill that would require a safety course for people who want to carry a concealed weapon. And Mary Margaret Oliver had a bill to ban assault weapons. And both of these bills appear to be going nowhere in the legislature, right?
Yeah, I would think so. And I don't think that's really surprising to anybody. And I think the political climate right now is just too hot for a lot of this. Yeah, immediately. When you put one of these bills forward, people begin to question what's the motivation here. Obviously, there's a huge fear about seizures of guns, that there doesn't really seem to be anything actually happening there. But there's a lot of concern that that could happen. And so I think the political climate's just not right for it. You start putting this stuff forward right now and people think that it's they're too nervous about it.
But, I'm sensing a change. I really am. I mean, since Zell Miller. Zell Miller is pretty much the fellow who took guns off the table for Democrats. He said, "Stop fooling around with this, all right?" And they've pretty much done this. But I think starting with Hillary Clinton, really, Obama first, and then Hillary Clinton has picked up on that. I think Mary Margaret Oliver is picking up off Ms. Clinton. I think we're on the cusp of it becoming a discussable topic among Democrats.
Well, I will say one thing. Yes, maybe among Democrats, but my daughter works at a gun store, and Obama and now Mary Margaret Oliver are their best salespeople.
And darn it all,
the Obamas should own stock in gun companies.
Absolutely.
We're out of time. We're out of time. Got to stop. Virginia Galloway, Howard Franklin, Ben Swan, Jackie Gingrich, Cushman, Jim Galloway. Thank you all so much for being here for Political Realm. And remember, we're back on the air Friday at 3:00 with a live show. If you can't be near the radio when we're on the air, you can listen to us by downloading the GPB Atlanta app. You can hear a Political Rewind, Two Way Street, On Second Thought with Celeste Headley, and all your favorite NPR shows right there. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again on Friday at 3:00.